I gave this title well before this weekend, and you know, as you'll see, I predict R of 0.2, so it's just no, only kidding. So this is work I have done with my student Anton De La Fuente, and so what I'm talking about is based on this paper and a number of other exercises we've done since. Okay, so I want to give a kind of, there's a rather precise technical result. That's it, but I wanted to give a kind of extended introduction to what are we even after, okay? So in quantum gravity, one of the tricky things is just figuring out what the question is, okay? What sensible questions are. So you can contrast this with just standard quantum field theory where the kind of questions we ask are these kind of correlated, time-ordered correlators of some typically the easiest things to ask about and the most probing and scalpel-like precision is asking about local correlators. And these local operators are nice gauge invariant quantities like this gauge invariant operator made out of the gluon field strength. Okay, so that's what standard flat space field theory is like. When you go to GR, you have the dynamics is, of course, the dynamics of space-time, so that's what I'm trying to illustrate here. And the problem is that there is no such thing as a local observable that satisfies the gauge invariance of the theory, and namely general coordinate invariance. Or, to think more physically rather than to say it formally like that, when you want to say, I want the correlator of this point, and this point, with three operators put there, three local operators, say the Ricci scalar or something like that, it's very hard to point to where you're pointing. Where is there, or there, or there? There are no names attached to these points fundamentally. And even the distances by which you might say this far from the other point or something like that, the distances themselves are the dynamical variables. So they're not sitting there for you to refer to in even framing the question. Okay? Now, we get around this. Most of us say, well, look, I live in a quantum gravity world, and never bothered me, all of this fussiness about what are the local variables and what are the local operators. And of course, one aspect is that the same sort of issue comes up in QED or in QCD, that we all talk about gluons and electrons. And these are also classic non-gauge invariant variables in gauge theory. We deal with it often enough in a practical way by saying, here is a local operator. It's the gluon field. And I'll just sort of fix the gauge. For example, there's this Lorentz-like gauge. Just think classically for a minute. And you can say, there, I've got this gauge fixing condition. Now I know exactly what I'm talking about. However, to get a random gauge field into this form, you'll see that secretly you're solving a non-local equation, meaning the solution of the equation is non-local. So if you imagine something which doesn't satisfy this form, you look for a gauge transformation that solves this equation. So it requires you to solve non-locally to find the global solution omega. And then after doing the gauge transformation by omega, you manage to get it in this form, okay, where the gauge transformation is of this form. So we're used to this. We've got this machinery under our belt. And of course, this way of thinking is incredibly useful perturbatively. Non-perturbatively, we find this kind of approach breaking down. In gauge theory, you have things like Gribov ambiguities. And the same kind of thing can be done in effective field theory in general relativity. Where we can quantize, we can treat it as an effective field theory, we can treat perturbative fluctuations with gauge fixing, and there's a whole machinery that goes along with it. And so certainly, perturbatively, for small fluctuations of the metric, this is a reasonable way to go, okay? Even more sort of pragmatically in the real world, we often work in a gauge without thinking about it, which is what I'll call a kind of unitary gauge for analogy, you would say, a Higgs theory of electroweak physics or something. And basically, you can imagine a state of the universe where there's just a lot of stuff in your universe. So here is a nice array of dust or something like that, galaxies in the universe. And you can use the array of junk in the universe as sort of reference points. And if you want to point to this correlator between these two places, you can just say, oh, well, I'm talking about a point inside the center of the sun and another in Alpha Centauri. And then I'm talking about that correlator. And if you think about it, this is sort of working in a kind of the state of all this dust is ultimately Higgsing general coordinate invariance enough that you can sort of point to different places in a clean way, okay? So this is, again, a useful way of doing things for small fluctuations of the metric, but in more violent situations, all these gauge-fixed ways of doing things break down, okay? If you want to have a cleaner and conceptually cleaner way of doing things, it is maybe not the only way, but it's one of the simplest ways, is if you're lucky enough to benefit from having a boundary of your dynamical space-time or some sort of asymptotic geometry that's not changing in your space-time, okay? So the simplest cartoon of this is imagine this rubber sheet, which is dynamical space-time, but at the edge of the sheet, I literally take it down and I sort of nail down this rubber sheet on the edge of a ruler, okay? So there it is, nailed down on the edge of the ruler, and so all these distances are now rigidly set. But the rubber sheet is sort of dynamical and fluctuating or quantum mechanically fluctuating. But now I can at least ask for boundary local operators. I can say, I want the correlator between this, this, and this, okay? Where these points, I now have a rigid ruler with respect to which I can point to them and say, give me that correlator. And everybody understands what we mean, okay? So in this cartoon is perhaps most closely well known in the form of the sort of boundary of anti-de Sitter space, which we'll talk about more, or in the sense of asymptotic infinity, the notion of a quantum gravity S matrix in Minkowski space. Okay, so for sufficiently high dimension, the quantum gravity S matrix is a good, generally coordinate invariant concept, and we can well pose quantum gravity questions and ask what is the S matrix. Doesn't mean we know the answers, but at least now we know what the question is. Okay, okay. So that's the direction I want to go. So this famous space-time anti-de Sitter space. Here is a picture of it. This is anti-de Sitter space in 2 plus 1 dimensions, which I'll be using a lot. For the GR people know what I'm saying, but all it means is that whenever I represent in any diagram you see in the talk, I will be representing space-times with some cartoon, which is just, if you just look at it, will not be faithful to the geometry that I'm drawing, but at least light rays are faithfully picked up. Light rays always travel at 45 degrees to the vertical, okay? So time, some notion of time is going up. 45 degrees to the vertical is the way time looks. And so this anti-de Sitter space in 2 plus 1 dimensions is, as far as light rays are concerned, equivalent to this sort of cylindrical space-time where the cross-section of any plane there is actually secretly a hemisphere, okay? But the main thing is that there is a generalization of the notion of S matrix. It's this sort of boundary correlator that I was just talking about, motivating in the cartoon, which is generally coordinate invariant. Namely, that if you take Feynman diagrams inside ADS, and you do a kind of analog of LSZ reduction, where you take the ends of the Feynman diagrams to the boundary of anti-de Sitter space, then you actually get a generalization of the S matrix, these so-called boundary correlators, okay? And they act very much like an S matrix would, except even better. But at the very least, they're like an S matrix in the sense that from the boundary, you can shine in rather sharply focused beams that can be made to collide in the interior. You might go into some resonance, some intermediate particle, and then things can come out, which can be decomposed in a basis of sharp beams going out. So it's very much the way that a collider physicist would like to think about scattering or probing any new physics, which is you can send in beams, and beams come out, and you can sort of read off what's going on, okay?
So there is the distance between the two points that you started with is a finite distance. So there is no notion of purely separating those two things.
So as I said, this way of viewing this picture is correct for light rays, but in fact, The geometry, which I'm not writing here, I will, but I'm not writing it right now, is a little misleading. These points at the boundary is, for any point in the interior, if you take what's the distance out to the boundary, it's infinite. It's infinite. And yet, the funny geometry allows light rays to go to the boundary and come back in a finite amount of time. So it's a kind of odd beast, okay? So it's a boundary in the very much the sense that causally it really matters. Stuff can go bounce off the boundary and come back in a finite amount of time for somebody who's just sitting in the interior. And so you really need boundary conditions, okay? That's really true. And yet, the distance out to the boundary is infinite, okay?
Break down if you're not a photon?
Yes, it would. Exactly. The time it would take you to get out there would still be infinite. It's only light rays that can do it. Yeah. I'll show you a metric in a second, which will make that obvious. Okay. So, of course, this is related to the famous ADS-CFT correspondence, which plays a role in this talk. But I like very much the sort of restatement of this principle, thinking of sort of the idea of looking for S matrices of quantum gravity by Witten in his thinking about what would play the same role in de Sitter space, okay? But when he points out the example of ADS, he sort of points out that if you look at the sort of operators, normally if you sort of do an S matrix and you look at the operators that you sort of put at infinity to create stable particles coming into a collision, all the particles at infinity in the S matrix sense in Minkowski space are free field operators, okay? It's effectively every stable particle, you think of it as a free field and you send and you use operators that create those particles and you send them into a collision in the interior. But they're effectively free at infinity. So what he points out is simply that in ADS, the analog of these operators at infinity, spatial infinity, okay, on this boundary of ADS, these operators actually, by the symmetries of ADS, are not in general free fields. In fact, they satisfy precisely the axioms of conformal field theory local operators. Hence, one way of saying ADS-CFT is, this way of thinking about what the S matrix of ADS is, I'm using S matrix in quotes, okay, is to say that the solution to quantum gravities in anti-de Sitter space is actually given by an actual conformal field theory, okay? That the notion of the generalization of S matrix in ADS is got within it the axioms of conformal field theory. So if you want to think of particular conformal field theories that sort of are living on this boundary of ADS, they would look like some sort of quarks and gluons. And these operators, these local sources that send signals into the interior of ADS would be local operators of the CFT, and the CFT is sort of living on the boundary in one dimension lower. So if this was ADS3, this would be CFT2, okay? Where this is time, and this circle is the space on which the CFT lives. Okay. And so you end up with this beautiful picture of what quantum gravity gives you, in this S matrix sense, what quantum gravity gives you on the boundary of ADS. These boundary correlators turn into local correlators of the CFT where the gravity is emergent. And this formulation is famously UV complete, but not just UV complete in the sense of string theory. It's also non-perturbative in the sense that perturbative string theory is not. Okay, it includes all the good things that you think about when you think about quantum gravity, like a sum over geometries, et cetera, et cetera. But in this form, it just looks like gauge theory. And non-perturbatively, here, we're including all that, not just small fluctuations, but all the large fluctuations. Yeah. Okay, so now we come to just putting the simplest thing with a horizon inside ADS, the sort of analog of the Schwarzschild black hole, which in anti-de Sitter space is an eternal black hole because the Hawking radiation, instead of escaping and causing the black hole to evaporate, is in equilibrium with the black hole, and the black hole lives forever. So in a space-time sense, just viewed like somebody would look at a black hole from the outside. There it is, and Hawking radiation is coming out. You can do all of the usual things that Hawking did. The dual of that, from the CFT point of view, well, the temperature of this Hawking radiation is suggestive, and in fact, it has been argued, and we'll talk about it a little bit more, that it is dual to, on the CFT side, to saying that there is a hot CFT living on the surface of the cylinder in space-time with some temperature which is non-zero, okay? And that temperature corresponds to this sort of Hawking temperature. But we can ask, what is the metric of this black hole? Just to see that it's not that, at first sight, that different from the kind of things you're used to seeing when you look at Schwarzschild solutions. So here it is in its perhaps most standard form. RS is the Schwarzschild radius, and this RADS is the radius of curvature of the asymptotic ADS space. So while the geometry here is not the same as ADS, asymptotically it is the same as ADS. It's asymptotic, so the asymptotic behavior is still anti de Sitter space, and it has a radius of curvature, RADS. And this is the angular dimension in 2 plus 1 dimensions as you're coming in. So this is the angular dimension going around. And as usual, it goes from minus pi to pi. For the rest of the talk, this standard way of thinking is a pain in the neck. So I'm going to rescale phi to something called sigma, where sigma is periodic, and as many things have been set to 1 as possible. Okay, so RADS, I'm going to use that as my yardstick. And then I'm going to get rid of the size of the Schwarzschild radius by putting it in this angular direction, by considering an angular direction or a periodic direction which goes from some number which is not pi and pi. Mostly this will not be in your face, but just remember that lambda, this construction here, this thing called lambda, is telling you how big a black hole it is. Okay. Okay, so the question comes up when we famously consider scattering, sending something inside the horizon of the black hole in order to scatter, okay? And you know, by conventional wisdom, it's lost to us, at least if we live on the outside, it's somehow lost, and its fate is uncertain, and so on and so on, okay? But we'd like to ask, what is the generalization of thinking about scattering, quantum gravity scattering, when it takes place inside the horizon? So we don't want to give up in the sense that we just say, well, it's gone inside the horizon and I'm done, okay? And we have this beautiful non-perturbative tool, the CFT, that should help us answer this, so we would like to understand it here, okay? So in fact, one can have a sharper view of what's going on inside the horizon by looking at this so-called extended black hole space-time. So let's look inside, extend the geometry inside the black hole. And in fact, you can keep extending the geometry. So here is sort of the Kruskal coordinates. This is just a rewriting of that black hole solution. But this solution makes sense in a larger regime than the Schwarzschild solution. And in fact, if I drop the angular direction, so I'm throwing this away, if I drop this angular direction and I only stay faithful to light rays by just dropping this, shall we say, I can just draw a picture of the time and radial directions, the u and v directions in this picture. So here are the u and v axes, and you can sort of think of this direction as being time. And I'm dropping the angular symmetry direction. Then you find that what we were calling the Schwarzschild black hole was just covering these two quadrants, okay? This is outside the black hole. But if you go inside the black hole, at least in a space-like direction, and come out here, you'll find another black hole exterior. So there are two exterior black holes, and they're joined at the hip inside the horizon, okay? So this is outside the horizon right, outside the horizon left, and then there is the future horizon and the past horizon. You can go inside. And if you go, once you're inside, you're inevitably, you're a time-like observer, time-like geodesic, you're going to head and hit the future singularity, okay? So ultimately, destruction awaits you. But what you do see in this picture is there's not just one boundary of anti de Sitter space. That boundary there in the schematic form is this boundary that you're seeing here, the surface of the cylinder. That's one boundary, but by not drawing things in 3D, I can show you that there is another boundary in this extended black hole. It's on the other side, going through this so-called worm, going in this direction, sometimes called going through a wormhole. Going in this direction is space-like. I can't actually do it, except as a mathematician here. But there it is, on the other side, is this other boundary of anti-de Sitter space. And as was deduced, starting here, ending roughly here, the dual of this on the CFT side actually looks like this. The two boundaries of these two asymptotic anti-de Sitter spaces correspond to two conformal field theories, conformal field theory right, conformal field theory left, each living on its own circle across time. Okay? And somehow, they are projecting, in some holographic sense, they are projecting this geometric behavior of the of this crustal extended black hole. Okay, and in fact, so we will review some of this. The quantum state of the black hole of this entire thing, the quantum state, sort of the classic construction is something called the Hartle-Hawking state of the black hole, is given on the CFT side by a very simple entanglement. So these two CFTs are dynamically decoupled. They do not talk to each other in the Hamiltonian. But the states here are entangled in this famous so-called thermofield entanglement form, okay, where you take the energy eigenstates of CFT left and the energy eigenstates of CFT right. Let's forget this little subtlety about CPT conjugation. You take these two energy eigenstates, both at the nth level, and weight it in this form, where beta is 1 over temperature in the Hawking radiation sense of the word. And you end up with this so-called thermofield state. Okay, so it lives in this CFT squared theory as an entangled state. And of course, if you only do probes on one side or the other, then you can only get some information out of this entangled. This is a pure state, but entangled. If you trace out, if you only do observables here and look at their correlators, then you find that you get exactly the Boltzmann distribution. Okay, so it's a very beautiful formalism that, or it's a very beautiful form of wave function such that observers of only one side of the quantum system, of this doubled quantum system, see a hot, impure state, but secretly the full system is in a pure state. Okay, so this already was argued by Maldacena to, I think, with very, very sharp evidence, that there are a number of things that are, even though these black holes don't evaporate, there are a number of sort of relatives of the black hole information paradox, which can be captured as questions even in this framework and look very puzzling in gravitational effective field theory to all orders in G Newton. In the G Newton expansion to all orders, things look bad. It looks like there's some proxy for information which is lost, where you can see that CFTs, which have this form, would actually give you the right answer, shall we say, okay? Give you something that preserves information. So I won't go through those exercises, but just to say there's a lot of detective work that's already occurred in this framework. Yeah?
Is it possible to actually deform this and just try different things on the right and the left?
Yes. I believe you can. You can choose, you can certainly entangle any two CFTs. I'll have to think whether I've already done, you know, you can, in fact, this form of thing is even more general. I could do QFTs entangled in this way. Now, if you're asking what is the gravity dual if I choose different CFTs, I'll have to think. Okay, so in some way, there's a lot that's been learned here. it is presumed that this sort of thermofield CFT state is somehow describing the whole thing, okay? But you would like to know, so what is the analog of the S matrix? So I don't want to know that in some vague way that the CFT knows the answer. I would like to know what are the sharp questions that I could, if I had a CFT computer, what question would I ask it to talk about probing, you know, scattering, in, you know, I send something in or send a couple of particles in and they scatter inside the horizon and I want to know what happens after that. What question would I have even if I had a computer that was running the CFT? That's the sort of sharp frame of mind that we're in. Okay. And here's the basic problem. You might say, look, I've got lots of boundary stuff here, and I know that's how I can ask very sharp quantum gravity questions, look at boundary correlators. But you can see the problem. Here I'm sending in a couple of particles that scatter inside the horizon. And somehow you'd like, that's great, it looks sort of like in-states coming in. But I'd like the out-states aspect of things. And you can see that if you have to get out to the boundary again, any point here would mean that I'd have to sort of go a space-like, I'd have to have space-like legs going out, okay? It's not really on-shell beams of particles coming out of a scattering. It's not the way that an LHC experimentalist would like to see particles going out to his detector, okay? So instead, when you draw diagrams like this and you compute, there are many morally equivalent sort of pieces of detective work. They're very useful in some way, but all of them have this sort of off-shell nature of probing inside the horizon. And these off-shell diagrams, as you are well aware, if you do off-shell diagrams of any sort, give you a kind of dim and rather diffuse, as opposed to sharp way of picking out what actually happened, okay? You can't really point to points locally inside the horizon and say something interesting happened there, okay? So just as a last part of what is the question, notice how interesting the insides of the horizons are. As is often said and is true, once you're inside the horizon, you find yourself, you know, the Schwarzschild radial direction R turns into a time-like direction, and you find yourself in a kind of cosmological space-time, okay? So what looks like a static black hole on the outside, once you're inside, is in a time-dependent cosmology. There is no time-like isometry inside the horizon, okay? And so if you like, this singularity that's inside it's a rather odd-looking cosmology compared to the FRW cosmologies you may be used to. It is anisotropic, for a starter. And it is, which you can tell just by looking at the Schwarzschild metric inside the horizon, and it is fueled by negative vacuum energy, which is the thing that gives you negative curvature inside the black hole. Again, I'll review that in a second. But it's an interesting question because the question I'm asking about the S matrix or whatever you want, the generalization of the S matrix, is simply this. Here is an interesting cosmology, in principle a quantum cosmology. Where are the true physical degrees of freedom of a quantum cosmology? In the holographic sense, where are they residing? Okay, that's the question I want to ask. And it should have teeth in the sense that it's not just some academic statement of the degrees of freedom lying XYZ, but these are the degrees of freedom that would mean something to an experimentalist. Okay, that's the way I'm thinking about it. So I think is a kind of toy model of a cosmology by embedding it in ADS and taking advantage of ADS CFT. The question is, do you have enough tools and control, theoretical control, to be able to sharply answer the question, where are the fundamental degrees of freedom of a quantum cosmology residing? Okay. Okay. So, with that very long introduction, let me just say, here are the goals, which we think we've done. That we want a new class of these CFT observables that, unlike the sort of boundary correlators that I showed you, which sort of probe the interior of the horizon in an off-shell and sort of diffuse way, we want CFT observables that more sharply probe inside the horizon. In fact, this 2 plus 1 dimensional black hole that I wrote down, the so-called BTZ black hole, we'd like to really say that these degrees of freedom or the observables should define some generalization of a quantum gravity S matrix. We'd also like to understand, sometimes when people talk about black hole complementarity, the question of in what sense is our events outside, inside the horizon, in what sense are they represented or captured by some strange, bizarre correlators outside the horizon, okay? These are related questions, and so I want to talk about that, okay? And the goal is that because we have this non-perturbative construction, the CFT, that all of these questions should not be answered in effective field theory on the gravity side. We can use that to do our detective work. But in the end, we want a prescription which is, in principle, totally non-perturbative. In the large N expansion on the CFT side, it should still be non-perturbative in this. So it should be true even for finite N. It should be beyond any order of effective field theory in gravity. Okay. And so what I want to quickly tell you is a kind of pictorial BTZ, because it's a three-dimensional black hole. You can get a lot of formulas by just drawing one picture. So I want to tell you about that black hole, describe how BTZ conformal field theory is related to just a Rindler view of ADS-CFT, horizons emerging by merely accelerated observers. I want to tell you how you actually do get some sort of a generalization of a S matrix inside the horizon, but at a seemingly deadly cost. That you actually need to look at correlators that are inside where, in other words, there are portions of the boundary that are secretly inside the singularity or behind the singularity, where normally you would tremble to go. Okay, the singularity.
You mean singularity, not event horizon?
No, singularity, not event horizon. Right. So this idea that secretly, before the bang, is where all the degrees of freedom that I'm talking about really reside, is supposed to be our revolutionary answer. The most obvious question is, isn't singularity really bad? Because like everything is infinite and stuff like that. So first, I will explain to you in what sense we find, I think for the first time, that if you keep really close track of the I epsilons inside propagators and so on, that these are finite correlators. But then you would be very suspicious, because you'd say, okay, I didn't follow that exactly, and I have no instinct for this, and this guy's just saying, okay, I epsilon saves the day, okay? Well, so that's true, but we went further. We said, why are good things happening to bad people? And so we go through this step. You've all heard that when you first learn about black holes, you say, it's like space and time trade places when you go inside the horizon. And of course, it's normally just coordinate trickery, right? So means nothing. But actually, we're claiming, no, it means something. And so we want to talk about this trade, the sort of seemingly equivalence of space and time in a very precise sense. I think I can even get it across. Once you're inside the horizon, and in conformal field theory terms. This is not just a kind of effective field theory of GR story I'm telling you. There's something rather precise in conformal field theory. And that, in fact, these crazy correlators, the ones that seem to have endpoints inside the singularity, secretly correspond because of this kind of equivalence or transformation. They correspond to non-local conformal field theory correlators, or, if you like, they correspond equivalently to non-local correlators outside the horizon. Okay? Secretly, they're not going into the deadly zone of the singularity. So that's the whole story.
The
singularity, so it'll turn out that the singularities are going to be not resolvable, okay? And yet there is going to be a sort of don't ask, don't tell aspect to them, which is the following. So if this is the singularity, and so one side of the singularity, the other side of the singularity, and you do some general Feynman diagram, then what we'll show is that, with just some mild technical caveats, that these kind of correlators are finite. Okay, However, suppose you decide to put a thermometer right near the singularity. By the way, this is a time-like direction in that way. Suppose you decide to do another thing where you say, okay, you know, how about I do this? I'll just end really close to the singularity. And that's sort of a Feynman diagram way of saying I stuck my thermometer there or something. Then these, as this point gets closer and closer to there, does diverge. Okay? Now, you've seen this before, and it turns in the arithmetic with the I epsilons, this will literally turn out to be the case. You've seen math that looks like this. It's called this. So if a and b are positive numbers and you do this integral, then this is of course famously finite because there are cancellations between the negative axis and the positive axis. Okay, it's like principal value. On the other hand, if I just take b to be zero, then this would be infinity. Okay, so there's this aspect to these kinds of correlators. You can scatter seemingly through this region, but if you actually try to sort of ask about what's literally if you keep your distance, at least it's interesting because you're starting to see bad behavior. But if you literally put yourself there on the singularity, all hell has broken loose. Okay, so part of the puzzle is to understand why should that be happening. Okay, so
somehow virtual space goes through the singularity.
Exactly, or rather, there's a cancellation. And I'll massage it into a form where you'll see in a, I think, even simpler to state way why there is this cancellation. Okay. There will be another question which I'll show you in a second, why you would even think this region, you could say, is it really there? Is it physical or is this pure math? And there's a sense in which it's pure math, and there's a sense in which it's physical, and I need to say it precisely, but I'm getting ahead of myself. So, okay. Yes? So this, in fact, the only controlled exercise of that type was done in string theory, in perturbative string theory, by Eva Silverstein and collaborators. And they did, in fact, claim that there was a smoothing out of this singularity in a particular way. But whether that happens in that particular string theory or in a general quantum gravity, there's a certain sense in which we're insensitive to it. So we've done a number of little examples of reproducing those kind of results and its connection to us. And as I said, here, why should I keep you in suspense? Because maybe I'd rather have a statement of the infomercial, but everybody understands what I'm talking about, even if it costs me a derivation. So remember that this is going up here, this is time. What this is, we'll talk about later, okay? But the sense in which this thing has all the features I said, so that nothing looks that mysterious to you, is that this time evolution here, let's call it U, okay? So this is time evolution, the unitary operator time evolution. These correlators that traverse in some way, they have a U daggerish form where I can, let me say that this is sort of T1. This is let's just call it T star. And this is T2. And the nature of the cancellations we're talking about are that you have a kind of T. So from T1 to T star. And here you have a T2, T star, T2. Let me get that right. I'll check my indices in a second. Let me say what's going on. If I, so maybe I should. So you can regulate, don't go all the way to the singularity. If I evolve, if I do unitary time evolution from T1 to T star, I will stop before all hell breaks loose and effective field theory dies or string theory dies. Okay, so that's that part there. And it turns out that there's a way of recasting the dynamics on this side so that you also sort of stay, I don't know. You also sort of keep your distance from the singularity on this side. And you find that you get that these correlators are described by something that has this kind of form, where there is cancellation of the time. In other words, the time evolution here and the time evolution here is sort of canceling out. That's the thing I'm trying to show you, okay? Which means that what you really have is safe time evolution up to here. And this matrix multiplication you're seeing is saying that safe time evolution up to here is entangled with safe time evolution in the sort of reverse direction down to here. Okay. So you're actually insensitive to, that's this aspect of the cancellation. You're actually insensitive to what's going on here. And you could, in fact, have stopped there as much as anything. Okay. So if I get a chance, I'll at least try to flash that aspect of it. Yep, sure. Okay.
This would be very, very, very telegraphic. Yeah. So, but is your statement contingent on the two T stars going to zero in a coordinated way somehow?
Yes. Although it's a little more forgiving than that, but you'll see. Yeah. Yes, it'll become clear. So let me keep going and let me get some of the things out. So why is the BTZ black hole the battlefield that we want to choose? And that's because at least it starts with a singularity which does not appear so singular. Okay? Out of all the 80 Schwarzschild black holes, it looks sort of like all of them superficially. But in fact, if you follow the curvature of space-time as you approach what I've been calling the singularity, you find that the curvature, all the curvature invariants, are actually constant as you approach the singularity. It's not blowing up. So at first sight, you say, it's not as deadly as what I thought would be a curvature singularity. Okay? And in fact, space-time can be, normally we call this the Kruskal extension of the black hole. Okay? And normally, this is as far as we can get before we just don't know how to classically or geometrically continue the space-time because of the intervention of the singularity. Because these singularities at first sight seem more benign, there is a way of extending beyond the singularities, okay? Yeah.
The walking Penrose theorem is valid because in classical GR, space-time is c2 smooth everywhere, including r equals 0. But quantum gravity, you expect to be stochastic. It's not going to be c2 smooth.
But you this is the moment, so we'll talk about the quantum effects. That's the whole talk. But this, yes, this. Indeed, we are going to see that there is sort of really teeth to the word singularity here. But for the moment, let me not be a physicist. I'll just be a mathematician looking at this geometry and saying it can be smoothly continued beyond that point. And
is that is there some special magic? Is this a special black hole?
No, in fact, as you see in my conclusions, one thing is that we expect something like this can happen in higher dimensional objects which are black, but they're just not black holes. But for the purpose, the moral point I'm making here, that would not be relevant. Okay, so what are these? It turns out it's very simple, that the BTZ black hole, there has a really big extension, which is you just take the ADS space that I showed you, that cylinder, and you identify various points using a discrete symmetry of ADS. Okay, so I'll show you what that is in a second. In fact, both for simplicity in drawing pictures and for a technical reason, which I will only get to if people ask me after the talk, I prefer to go to a kind of intermediate extension, which is to think of BTZ as a identification of points, which I'll show you, a very bizarre identification of points, which I'll show you, starting from the so-called Poincaré patch of ADS, which is much easier to draw pictures of and much easier to have intuition for, and also has a technical advantage that I won't talk about. So here is ADS global. It's this cylinder and its interior. And this little sort of slice of it is ADS Poincaré, okay? And if you take this whole thing and deform it and rewrite it in a way that preserves 90 degrees for light rays, you end up with something that just looks like this three-dimensional space, time going up here, so-called Poincaré time. It's not the same as this time, but it's a time-like direction, x going off in this direction infinitely, and z going off half infinitely in this direction. And z equals 0 is the boundary. It's the boundary part that fits inside the Poincaré patch. And the metric just has this form that many of you have seen before. I'll drop the RADS. And it just looks like Minkowski space, or half of Minkowski, since z is positive, half of Minkowski space in three dimensions. As far as light rays are concerned, it's just half of Minkowski space in three dimensions, but with this so-called warp factor thrown in. Okay, and you can check the statement that I was telling Gordon earlier, namely that z equals 0 is infinitely far away from anywhere in the bulk, but light can go there and back in a finite time because it doesn't even know about this. It just thinks z equals 0 is a regular Joe point in the middle of space. Okay, so here is the BTZ black hole. I'm going to tell you how to glue points together in order to make it. Sometimes people would worry that BTZ is a theory in three dimensions and there are no such things as gravitons in three dimensions. Actually, everything I'm saying, except drawing the pictures, everything I'm saying is true if it's ADS cross some other factor of space-time where you have higher dimensional gravitons and all the good stuff, quantum gravity, all the things you worry about can be there. That's not an issue for anything I'm saying. But here's what you do. You take the ADS space that I've shown you, and here's one way to say it. It's at least provocative enough that I can draw it very quickly. You take this inner hemisphere, the surface of the inner hemisphere, and you identify it with the surface of the outer hemisphere. Okay? If that was, so a couple of things that sound crazy in that. One, the inner hemisphere doesn't look like it is sort of symmetrically something you can glue to the outer without stretching it in some way. But in fact, because of this warp factor, it's easy to check that they are, in fact, these two hemispheres are the same size. So they can be glued together. And you live in what we have been calling to ourselves the coconut shell, okay, that's in between there. The second thing that's bizarre is that would be fine if this was Euclidean space. And I told you to do that. That would be a reasonable thing to do. You would end up with what is topologically a sort of solid torus. Okay, but this is space-time that I'm doing this to. And so this identification, another way to think about it mathematically is this is the identification I'm doing. Lambda is the parameter that tells you about the size of the black hole. And this is the identification I'm telling you to make. Okay, just thinking in the radial direction, in any direction, you sort of make this identification. It looks insane, but that's the thing that gives you the BTZ black hole. And so if you like, the symmetry that I'm using to make these identifications is this lambda particular choice of a discrete dilatation. And indeed, you can go through and check all the different coordinate systems, the Poincaré coordinate system, and you can compare it to the Kruskal coordinates and the Schwarzschild coordinates. It all works. That is a construction of this black hole. And for all of us who are more used to very simple ways of quotienting, you can take a plane and quotient it by translations. You get a cylinder and so on. And of course, all the physics has to be worked out by the method of images, whether you're in effective field theory or on the CFT side. So that's the method that we're using. So here is, to see more of what's going on and what's bizarre about this black hole, or at least the different regions I'm showing you, here are these sort of planes, these blue planes cutting through like this, sort of like cutting through an orange or something, right? And so before doing this identification, it's usually called a quotient, before doing this quotient, If I just put these 45 degree line sort of blue planes cutting through anti-de Sitter space, they would actually be Rindler horizons for anti-de Sitter space, okay? But in this sort of warped Minkowski space, which is called ADS Poincaré, okay? So Rindler horizons are very interesting. Everybody learns a lot by working through the Rindler horizon story, which is secretly the story as viewed by accelerated observers, sort of self-created horizons, if you like. But after doing this quotient by identifying the inner and outer hemisphere, these horizons are really locked in. They are, if you like, more physical in some way, okay? So there's just a hair's breadth of difference between what is a mere Rindler horizon and turning it into the real horizon of, I don't know whether there is such a thing as a real horizon. Anyway, the real horizons of this black hole. And now you can see the pathology. This kind of identification must just look so screwy from the viewpoint of Minkowski space. And so let me show you why. Because just take any radial ray, okay? So if I take a radial ray that's sort of got this sort of space-like orientation, then once I make the identification of a point here with a point lambda bigger, it looks like a space-like circle, okay? That's great. I wanted to be on space-like circles from the outside of the black hole. I have these space-like circles there. It's called the phi direction or the sigma direction. It's the angular direction that I've been talking about in the black hole. On the other hand, if I take a time-like oriented ray that goes inside this 45-degree light cone, it looks like it repeats itself, and yet it's time-like. And so you end up having time-like closed curves. So that's pathology number one. But then if you take a ray that literally lies on this 45-degree light cone, then it is a light-like ray, but it repeats itself because of this quotient, and so it is a light-like circle, okay? And it's the space of these light-like circles, which when you look in these crustal coordinates, it's the space of these light-like circles which actually is what we're calling the singularity. So even though in this geometry, none of the curvature invariants are different from the covering space before you do the quotient, once you do the quotient, something pathological does happen, or weird or bizarre, does happen on this light cone-like surface. It turns into a set of light-like circles, okay? And you might think that plays havoc with physics. Indeed, it is true, it does. It does play havoc with physics. It plays havoc in all the senses you might worry about. And indeed, these guys said it in a very nice way, that if you take this smooth geometry, albeit with light-like circles, and you just try to probe it the way a physicist wants to make sense, to make sure anything is actually real, put a particle in there and test it, as soon as you add a particle to this benign, smooth surface mathematically, it turns into a real curvature singularity. So it's deadly. It's like a bomb. And it says it hasn't gone off, and then you put one little match to it, and poof, okay, that's it. So it has been argued that the singularity is as singular as you want, because as soon as you attempt to do physics near it, it goes off. Okay. Now I won't repeat their sort of GR-based argument. I'll give you something even more obvious in the diagrams. And there's sort of a history of worrying about light-like circles because they are field-theoretically pathological. But it's easy to sort of see why by just studying the propagator in ADS and how you use the method of images to get the propagator in BTZ. The propagator in ADS depends on something, sort of the analog of distance in anti-de Sitter space, the invariant distance, which is sort of got this form for two points, x and x prime, okay? So that's it. And if you look at what you get in BTZ, when you sum over images, the images of this quotienting or identification by lambda, so you can image one of the points, say the primed, the unprimed point is imaged. then what you find is, it's very easy, you can see that generic points, for generic points, as you sum these large number of images, the term inside the argument here goes like lambda to the minus n. And then using the asymptotics of the propagator of in ADS, you find that this converges very exponentially fast. So so you only keep a few images. However, there's precisely one place where, again, you can see by eye that that story must break down. If you're near the singularity, this light cone condition, then you find that numerator and denominator have both the same power of lambda to the n. Instead of lambda to the 2n here and lambda to the n, all the lambda to the 2n terms cancel out. And you're just left with lambda to the n over lambda to the n, which means that you're summing something that behaves like a constant in n infinitely many times. And that's the source of the singularity. That's why light-like circles give rise to such terrible behavior. Okay. So in the end, you end up with this map of the universe, which looks like this. Okay. I'm not drawing the coconut shell on top because it would be too busy, but that identification of x with lambda x and so on is implicit here. Outside these two blue horizons on the left and on the right is actually outside the black hole, okay? The two black holes. Inside the blue, you're inside the horizon. So in this future horizon up here and past horizon down here. But eventually, once you're inside the horizon, this light cone is expanding at the speed of light. So you're going to go through it. And when you go close to it, you hit all the singularities of Feynman diagrams blowing up in your face because of what I just pointed out. Okay? And if you are inside it, if somehow you made it in, I'm calling it crazy land, it's usually called a whisker, but it's called that, I'm calling it that because you've got time-like circles. So you don't even if you did finite calculations there, what the hell is the interpretation? Okay? That's the way it appears. Okay? So one can now understand with this setup, you can understand sort of where the BTZ, where the conformal field theory dual of ADS black holes, in particular BTZ, comes from by starting with no compactification, or if you like, no quotienting, in which case I don't have the coconut shell, I just have everything that looks that you can see here. And basically, it's the conformal field theory normally in ADS just lives on the entire boundary. But I can restrict the conformal field theory from living on the entire boundary to just living outside the horizon in these left and right wedges. Okay, so it seems like just part of the story. Okay. Once I compactify, the statement is that you end up, then these two wedges here look like conformal field theory on time across the circle, time-like direction across the circle. And the way that they project everything in the bulk is by being entangled with each other. Okay? And we can see where that comes from by just doing the no quotienting case, where it turns out to be this very beautiful observation that there is a Rindler view of ADS CFT. So what does it mean when you stay out, there's secretly a conformal field theory on the entire surface z equals 0. But I'm not looking at all of it. I'm only looking at the CFT outside the horizon. Well, before quotienting, outside the horizon means I am looking at a kind of Rindler view of the conformal field theory. I'm only asking questions that can be seen by observers that never go inside the horizon, the so-called Rindler observers, okay? And you can see what kind of a world they see by looking at the CFT living in these two wedges of z equals 0. And there's a very nice coordinate transformation we can do, just this one, okay? And the beauty for a conformal field theory is that this is a conformal transformation. And what it does is it takes an entire plane, a Minkowski plane, and it smushes it just in the right. And it takes an entire Minkowski plane and smushes it just in the left. Okay. And what it's describing in these lines, these are the lines of accelerated observers who never go inside the horizon. And like all accelerated observers, if they're carrying some detector, it goes off even though they're only traveling in the vacuum, okay, the Minkowski vacuum of the CFT. And I won't go into the details, but it's plausible that the way it goes off is described by some sort of a temperature. This constant acceleration turns into a kind of a temperature. And so what is, after all, the Minkowski vacuum is seen by these accelerated observers as a sort of thermal system. But secretly, it's a pure state. It's a pure state of these two CFTs, but each CFT by itself is only able to probe part of that story, and it looks approximately thermal, the so-called thermal field state. To go to, so in particular, if you want correlators on the left and the right, you just get, so they would normally, you would say, I'm looking like a Minkowski guy, I would say it's just some time-ordered product of correlators, of operators. But in the thermal field way of writing it, you write it as some sort of thermal correlator. And this is what that equivalence, the Rindler view of this is this. Okay, that's the technical form. For once you do the quotienting, to say it quickly, you get the analogous result by method of images. Namely, that correlators on the left and the right, outside the black hole, on the boundary correlators outside the black hole, are given by a kind of thermal field form, or if you like, the Hartle-Hawking state of BTZ is given by a thermofield entanglement of two CFTs, decoupled CFTs. Okay, so this is just the way, that's the general understanding already prior to our work. So let me just say what happens here when we get into our fundamental question. Maybe I've somehow prepared a couple of particles that are coming from outside the horizon. They enter into the horizon, they turn into fuse into a Z boson or a small black hole or whatever, and I want to know what happens next. But if I'm only allowed to ask boundary correlator questions that are on the outside, then these green lines are always going to be space-like, okay? They're never going to correspond to what we would call sharp beams going off to the detector. That's just the restatement now that we've got all this three-dimensional view of the original problem. But the similarity to the Rindler story tells you where to look for the answer, okay? So before quotienting, when you draw diagrams like this and you want to know what correlator should I ask to find out what happened to that Z boson when it decayed inside the horizon, everybody knows that the answer is you'd want something that's, you know, where these lines sort of go off in time-like or light-like directions. Sorry, it looks a bit bent. Time-like or light-like directions, in which case it's going to hit the boundary inside that cone, okay, in this sort of future boundary region. And indeed, these are the things that correspond in ADS before quotienting. These are the correlators that correspond to sort of sharply probing what happened during the scatter, okay? And it suggests that maybe one should consider correlators that look like this, that end in, once you quotient this, this region is called crazy land, right? So maybe one should consider that.
Would it also work if you're exchanging the p-tunnel exchange and you have to integrate the points across the singularity? Through a p-tunnel propagator?
No, you're saying if the T-channel occurred entirely inside the horizon, would that...
Well, the T-channel occurs anywhere, right? Yeah,
it could occur inside, yeah.
So there's also a point where you're slipping through the singularity.
Yeah, by the way, one way that we've tried to sharpen our thinking here is we're even imagining preparing these beams coming in so that they are going to only overlap inside the horizon, just so that we force the issue and don't leave any other options open. Which you can do, even in ADS, how to make these guided beams, even from the CFT side, is known. Okay. Indeed, one way of thinking of what these boundary correlators before quotienting, what these boundary correlators do, you can just sort of visually imagine, is by doing the sort of gravitational path integral inside this space-like cone, okay, you can think of these operators or correlators, where you insert operators here, as sort of, but by doing the sort of path integral inside the red cone, as setting up a final state before you get to this light-like cone. You end up with a final state on the space-like hypersurface, and it acts as a kind of very simple knowable outstate. Okay? So it's the best thing that you have in ADS, which corresponds to essentially free particles headed outwards. Okay. So the idea of these correlators ending in the future boundary makes sense, but when you go to the case where you finish quotienting, then it looks like you got to go into crazy land. That's the only way you could hope to probe it. And the questions are, is this finite? Is this finite despite the fact that it goes through the singularity? Is it physically sensible? Is there physics to going into a region with time-like circles? And is it in any way in keeping with the original statement of duality in terms of entangled CFTs? Okay. So we've studied that, and the answer is yes to all of those. So let me, for lack of time, I'm going to give you one punchline. Okay. And I'm happy to keep going, but let me give you one punchline that you can sort of see. So perhaps the biggest thing is, look, is it finite? It's sort of the questions that were asked when I was just starting. And indeed, all the pathologies in diagrammatic terms comes from this sort of sum over images of propagators that are part of Feynman diagrams, starting from the ADS propagator. And indeed, you can analyze what is the behavior of the BTZ propagator as one of the points in a propagator approaches the singularity. And it's very easy. You can maybe do it in your head, but you can, if you're careful, you can just see that it's got this kind of logarithmic behavior, which if the I epsilon wasn't there, would become singular when you hit the light cone. Okay. This I epsilon is us being careful. It's very important. You can be very sloppy about implementing I epsilon if there was no sum over images. And that's more or less how it has been done in the literature. When you have to do this sum over images very carefully. The epsilon is small, but the number of images can be large, and you have to be careful. This is the result. And so the typical diagrams that you get when this is the bad behavior of the propagator near the singularity, they have this form. Okay, I'm being a bit schematic. Powers of logs or derivatives of log. If you have derivative interactions, like general relativity famously does, then you get the log turning into denominators like this. And you have to integrate some interaction vertex. And the interaction vertex can go through the singularity, okay, which would be t equals 0, the way I've written it. Okay. Without the I epsilon, you end up repeating a number of the derivations that are seen in the literature of why this is really bad news. Okay. But when you're careful about the I epsilon, this is something either you know, or if you play around with it for yourself for 5 minutes, you'll quickly see that this is in fact finite. By the way, how much earlier and how much later is sort of determined by the other ends of these propagators, sort of by the questions that you're asking. Okay. But basically, these diagrams that traverse the singularity but don't have endpoints right on the singularity will have this kind of finiteness. That's what I advertised to you earlier. Okay. And so we've done this to fairly, to some set of diagrams that we think are seemingly lethal, the ones that we've already seen in the literature claiming that they are lethal. And But we've also tried to do all diagrams by being more efficient. And let me say that the way to do that is to sort of rotate. This is a purely passive thing. You write down the integral over Feynman vertices, and you just observe that there is the right analytic structure in these propagators to allow you to rotate in the complex plane the z coordinate. And when you do that, you find that your BTZ propagator stuffed in the middle of some Feynman diagrams for finite rotation is in fact convergent. There is effectively no singularity. There's no free lunch. If you try to put endpoints of diagrams on the singularities, you will not be able to do this rotation. Okay. So basically, this is only trying to do efficiently what I'm saying to you we see in simple diagrams inefficiently, that there is a cancellation that's taking place at the singularity. Okay, I think I'm out of time, and therefore I need to make this executive decision before somebody makes it for me. So let me say that the true understanding of why these things are happening, why is it working out, is related to this thing I'm talking about, which is space and time trading places. And before you think that that's, again, insanity, let me just point out that in 1+1 dimensional field theory, the symmetries of the light cone, you normally say that's sort of future light cone, past light cone, and these other directions, the spatial directions, they're usually several such spatial directions. Of course, in 1+1 dimension, there's just one spatial direction, one time direction. The signature 1-1 is just as good as -1, 1. You might think there's something like an x to t symmetry. Okay. At first, that seems totally at odds with causality, that somehow these light cones are very different from these light cones. But in fact, that's not true. Okay. So I was going to take you through that. This is the way that you really understand the nature of that cancellation, that it is not kind of a technically fortuitous cancellation, but that what is behind the singularity is secretly a copy of what is in front of the singularity, but written in a way which makes non-local correlators, non-local observables, look local. We are sometimes told this sort of prophecy that processes inside the horizon by some form of complementarity are hidden in very subtle correlations outside the horizon, okay, in a true quantum theory of gravity. And you'd love to know, okay, so which correlators or which non-local correlations are you pointing to? And we're not very good with non-local correlations. But if there's a way of turning non-local operators into local operators, which we have much better intuition for, then we would all be infinitely happy. That's exactly what happens, and it happens by virtue of this kind of a weird transformation. And helps to understand in what sense you really are not sort of going near the danger zone of the singularity. The singularity really is singular. I'm going to stop there because I see I've gone over time. And people want to talk to me afterwards, that's fine. Question? Oh, hey, Anthony.
But I don't see how you could have a smooth extension across the singularity, because in some sense that's not a singularity there. So I'm assuming there's some discontinuity in the metric, and so I guess I would wonder, how is this extension unique across the singularity? So do you have some explanation of that?
Yes. At the technical level at which I was showing you, you're bypassing. So there's some singularity in the real axis for x, y, x, t, and z. And what you're showing is that the correlators that traverse the singularity, that interaction vertices, which have to be integrated x, t, z, that you can deform the contour to dodge the singularity, which is on the real axis, by going into the complex plane.
Yeah, I guess I was asking more about the geometry that you were saying. Is that, I guess you're somehow, it seems like you're assuming something for about the geometry on the other side of this singularity, and I'm wondering how you actually know what that is, and how do you match the right geometry on either side?
In each case, you're sort of, so technically you're starting with an act of faith that you're going to depart from the geometry that you get purely by taking this quotienting procedure seriously. And then you're doing effective field theory correlators on top of that. And so if you say, what's the geometry on the other side? I'm taking this unbackreacted geometry as my background spacetime. And even if I am doing, you know, I was doing scalar fields, but if I were doing gravitons or something like that, I would think of those as a field living on that particular fixed geometry. So I know what that fixed geometry is. It's the thing you get by taking ADS and gluing some points in a well-defined way, okay? Now, maybe your question is, how do I know there isn't some big back reaction that changes the geometry, or are you asking something else?
Somewhere in this space-time.
There's no curvature singularity. There's no curvature singularity before back reaction is taken into account. So there is this nice symmetry quotient of ADS that gives you a smooth fixed curvature geometry, including the region of time-like circles, light-like circles. Everything is constant geometry. Is fixed curvature, and on that, I'm starting to do Feynman diagrams. So the rationale for thinking, wait, all hell has got to break loose near the light-like circles from the Feynman, so matching up with any other way of thinking about it, but you can think about Feynman diagrams, is that when you do Feynman diagrams and you look at endpoints of the Feynman diagrams near the light-like circles, all those Feynman diagrams blow up. And if you think of these endpoints as being, say, the end of some graviton leg, then it's saying that the curvature is back react. There's a Feynman diagram computed curvature back reaction at what used to be a smooth geometry. And the back reaction is infinite. So typically, infinite curvatures are generated. However, that's only if you take your little curvatometer and put it there. If I don't end a Feynman diagram on the light-like circles, on the quote singularity, those Feynman diagrams are finite. That's this thing I'm pointing to. But to do that computation, I have this a priori unbackreacted geometry is smooth. So I know what I'm doing. I know how to set up the problem. And you're letting the Feynman diagrams decide, either blow up or don't blow up. But I'm saying they don't blow up.
Vulnerability, does that extend past the singularity happening because you're in three dimensions because you have no biotensor? The thing on the Schwarzschild in four dimensions that would have been blowing up would be the biotensor squared, right? And you don't have that because you have to.
The question is whether this is sort of intrinsically three dimensional. And apparently, so we haven't done this project yet, but we've seen the prerequisites in the literature. There are higher dimensional, I don't know what they are, black rings or something like that, which have the same feature that you get them by quotienting ADS itself. And by smoothly quotienting ADS, it's always got the same constant curvature. Locally, it has the same constant curvature as ADS itself. But globally, it's not ADS.
They all have the property that there's three coordinates that are doing something interesting and all the rest are symmetry directions?
I don't think so. I don't think it's all three-ness, but it's just possible. It's possible. So I'm not as familiar with those. This question back.
Can you give a glimpse of VNC answers?
Sorry.
Can you sketch some answers to B and C, your question B and C? How is it very easy to
visual
CFT that?
Yes.
Before we go into a long answer, Winston, did you have a short question?
It might be short.
Yeah, okay. I was wondering, I epsilon, which seems important for you,
yes.
in quantum mechanics field theory, could be thought of a dividing switch on of the sources and switch off of the detectors.
Yes.
Did you think of a more physical connection here? I mean, maybe it's related to the way you prepare your beams?
I think the I epsilon that we're using is crucially related to defining. So as you say, I epsilon is, we invoke it in propagators for general correlators, and the endpoints you can think of having sources that create the particles and detect the particles. The other sense in which we have I epsilon, which is perhaps more relevant to what's going on here, is that if you remember all your derivations of path integrals and so on, the I epsilon is the thing in the path integral which projects you onto the ground state, normally Minkowski space ground state. Here, that's exactly the role that's going on. The I epsilon in ADS Poincaré is precisely the thing that puts you on the ADS Poincaré looks like Minkowski space with some sort of warp factor in some other direction. The I epsilon is doing exactly the business of putting you onto the Minkowski, Dummo Minkowski ground state. But when you orbifold or quotient the way I'm doing, and you continue to use that I epsilon, that I epsilon now is defining a particular quantum state in this, I talk about this classical geometry, the BTZ black hole geometry. You have to ask, what quantum state are you talking about? And the I epsilon is doing the job of deciding which state you are in. And this I epsilon, by just taking the I epsilon from Poincaré and continuing to use it, is knowably giving you the Hartle-Hawking ground state. So I would say the I epsilon is related to the ground state, or in quotes, ground state. And in this case, it's the Hartle-Hawking state that you're trying to project onto. So shall I answer this other? Yeah. So let me see if I can at least make the statement, which is here. Yeah, okay. Well, let me say it in small bites, and then people can ask me to expand if necessary. Sorry? Yes, the question is, so I said there was sort of a full satisfaction if you ask, what is this other way of thinking about these correlators that end in the crazy land region, which I'm saying are the ones that really probe the interior of the black hole, that there's some other way of writing them using X to T and all, some other manipulations, right? There's some other way of writing them in which everything is consistent with sort of the standard CFT dual of BTZ or any of these Adiós-Schwarzschild black holes, and yet turns what seem like local correlators, but in crazy land, into non-local correlators, but with no mention of crazy land, okay? So here's the answer. The answer is, once you take into account this X to T-like symmetry that is present even in CFTs, even non-perturbatively, in 1+1 dimensions, you find that regular correlators, so let me not even do the quotienting or anything yet, because this is a point that could be made without doing any quotienting, and it would already be an interesting result, okay? Here is a set of time-ordered correlators with some sources for some operators that we're interested in looking for correlators of, okay? And so here's the way that typically generating functional in quantum field theory looks like this, right? Regular time ordered, so this is Poincaré time, just the TZX, the TXZ theory. Time ordered correlators with Hamiltonian evolution and some sources for some operators. Great. Some of these operators might lie, so if I have to draw a picture just for a second, some of these operators Here's the boundary. Here's the z direction. Some, let's take these to be boundary correlators. So there are some operators that lie here in this sort of future wedge, some that lie here in the past wedge, some that lie here on the left, some that lie here on the right. So we have sources which are non-zero in all these different regions. And so here's the question, okay? And this is the usual way we would attempt to go at it. But turns out there is a way that the CFT, restricted only to these two so-called Rindler wedges, can answer correlators even though some of the operators are in these regions. Okay? And this is by a knowable piece of algebra, okay? And here's the answer. The answer is you write the Hartle-Hawking or the thermofield in the CFT language. You write the thermofield state. And remember, the thermofield state is a state in CFT squared, CFT left tensor, CFT right, okay? And so here is an operator that is a tensor product. First, forget all the exponentials, and forget this thing called P and F, the U hat P and F. Just drop all that. Then all you're staring at there is this. U hat left tensor, U hat right. Okay. This is all you're staring at, where each of these U hats is just a Rindler time ordered exponential of source terms. Okay. Now, at that level, if you forget all this exponential junk and all the things with P's and F's on it, and you're just looking at this, this is a very conservative statement for this field, which is to say that correlators which only involve left and right, okay, where operators are only on the left and the right, there are no sources for operators in the future and the past, will turn into correlators of those left and right operators inside the thermofield state. Okay? That's the statement. That is precisely what Rindler quantum field theory tells you when applied to a conformal field theory. So that's well known and everybody gets it. The new element is that if you have sources in the future and the past, you treat them exactly like, in this case, I'm showing you the past operators are treated exactly as some form of left operator, but sandwiched between these objects. I'll tell you what they are in a second. And when sandwiched between them, it takes what are local operators, and the effect of these guys is to turn them into highly non-local operators. So I'll explain in 1 second. Okay. And so the statement is that if you want to calculate correlators with operators in all four regions, you end up calculating it just as if it was always involving operators outside on the left and the right, but where some of the operators are highly non-local, okay? And what is this P minus, just so we know what it is? As I said, this x plus or minus t, these light cone coordinates in Minkowski space, can be written in terms of these so-called Rindler coordinates. These are the coordinates carried by Rindler observers, accelerated observers, who always stay on the outside of the horizon. And these p plus or minuses, I think I've written everything there carefully in p minus, this is nothing but the thing that acts, it's the conjugate. It's the conjugate momentum to this. Okay? So it's just one of the symmetry charges. It's one of the symmetry charges of the compact CFT, of the CFT on a circle cross time, but in this Rindler copy of it. And so what happens if you take a regular Heisenberg operator at some particular sigma and tau, and you do things like this, weird things like this. That is no longer a local operator, okay? In order to figure out how this acts, you would want to take any of these operators and sort of work in momentum basis and then do this weird smearing that I'm talking about, okay? So this is a well-defined CFT operation. But what it's doing is taking local operators and trading them for some weird non-local operator. But on the other hand, it is operators that just live in CFT left and CFT right. And the claim is they manage to give you the correlators in all four regions. Okay, so that secretly, the so-called whisker operator, local operators in the whisker, are secretly nothing but a kind of a local way, local but crazy looking way, of writing sensible non-local operators in the sort of what you'd call the physical region. Okay. It turns out that in this form, you can see the cancellation that's happening at the 45 degree, at this light cone, is actually manifest here. And maybe I'll just say that and then stop, because that takes, I think, 1 minute. As long as you stay away, as long as your sources are not on the light cone, on this 45 degree line, as long as your sources aren't there, then all the sort, so Heisenberg operators are a little bit high tech. They contain a lot of sort of regular time evolution that is put into them, right? But basically, so getting to this 45 degree line is called tau. Tau goes to infinity, okay? But if you only have sources, which are not right on that line, then you only need to go to sort of finite tau and stop, okay? When you're using these Heisenberg operators. Why? Because this is U dagger, the sort of late time evolution here cancels against late time evolution here as long as there are no sources. As long as there are no sources, time evolution here commutes with P minus. Why? Because P minus is a symmetry, or isometries of this sort of Rindler spacetime, and even after quotienting. Okay. So the cancellation that is saying that you're insensitive to what the dynamics is as you literally are getting very close within a string length of the singularity is actually something you see here once you derive this result. But I'm hoping at least what you see here is that the claim is that we're only doing something very sane. This was a very sort of geometric way of getting to it or being inspired to it. But in the end of the day, you're trying to say that everything is about the right non-local operators. Those are the ones that see inside. They see something like S matrixy, like matrix elements inside scattering in the black hole.
What's that?
It's the sanest thing in crazy land.
It's the sanest thing in crazy land. Or this part of crazy land is not so crazy.
In fact, you know, the thing about time-like circles is this, that if you somehow change what you're calling space and time, then the time-like circle becomes a space-like circle. So the way you get very conservative but non-local looking forms like this is you have to see how this x to t, which I'm hoping is at least plausible in 1 plus 1 dimensions, you have to see how x to t would work. And then it's at least vaguely plausible that the thing you're worrying about, time-like circles, will turn into space-like circles under x to t. That's exactly what happens, and then you end up with very sane-looking expressions, albeit non-local.